This is Dr. Colin Chapman. He is a professor in both the School of the Environment and in the Department of Anthropology at McGill, where he holds the Canada Research Chair in Primate Ecology and Conservation. He is a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada, and for the past 20 years, he has been an honorary lecturer at Makerere University in Uganda, where he conducts his fieldwork. And he will talk to us today about the influence of human-mediated environmental change on the emergence of primate diseases.
Okay, thank you, Tony, and thanks to the MSC for organizing all of this. I'm going to talk about something a little bit different. I'm going to talk about things that are kind of happening within these landscapes we're talking about. And I'm going to talk about diseases. And this is something I've been interested in for the last decade or so. And we have diseases like SARS and swine flu that, you know, hit the media a few years ago. We all know about Ebola and the devastating effect that Ebola has on human populations. And I'll tell you soon that it has an effect on animal populations as well. And, of course, we all kind of are aware of both the intense kind of social, economic effect of things like the HIV virus and AIDS. So we kind of have heard all about this, and I want to kind of start kind of explore with you some of the potential consequences for some of the process you've been hearing today. So there's just a kind of partial list of diseases that you can get if you basically associate with primates. Or that have come directly from primates. And I'll give you a couple of examples to talk about to start with. Let's talk about one that, you know, basically everyone kind of is really aware of because of its impact, AIDS. AIDS basically comes from two species of primates. It basically is a virus that is found in chimpanzees, and you have multiple types that have come from chimpanzees to humans. And it's also a virus that's found in sooty mangabeys, and it's come to humans. So it really results from a virus jumping from one host to another host. When it hits humans, basically it's called AIDS, and it's basically caused dramatic impacts. What I'll be talking about really is kind of the intermingling between kind of public health and conservation. So let me kind of give you two examples of where both of them are mixed, but we can kind of think about the importance of them. So let's talk about Ebola. You probably heard a lot about Ebola. You know how kind of devastating it can be to human populations when it gets into a small village. And you've probably seen, you know, basically film footage of, you know, people going in environmental suits to small African villages. Well, it definitely has a devastating impact. But it also has a devastating impact to the wildlife population. And you probably don't hear a lot about that because in some ways you don't know a lot about that. But Ebola has been related to population declines in chimpanzees of about 89%, and in gorillas, 56%, across kind of a broad range of Africa, kind of mostly the Central Africa. In one national park, Ebola basically resulted in the decline of 93% of the gorilla population. And that's the best kind of documented case. So we have these diseases that are causing dramatic impact on our wildlife, even if they're not fragmented, even if they're kind of all sorts of different types of habitats. Then you have things like this, which we should also think about when we're thinking about exchange of diseases. Gorilla tourism is a really big money-making event. It's one of the biggest things that's contributing to the economy of Uganda and Rwanda right now. This is kind of just a scene from Uganda, and this is a baby gorilla who died basically because it picked up scabies, which it got because it went into kind of human villages. So there was exchange of diseases in that situation. You probably all here think about malaria, and probably somebody in this audience has had malaria. I at least one of them. Mosquito-borne. This is a pretty crude estimate, but it's estimated there are 300 to 500 million clinical cases of malaria every year, and it causes between 0.7 and 2.7 million deaths per year. My guess is this is a really severe underestimate because most people that die of malaria don't go to the clinics. But put it in a poignant kind of example, every 40 seconds a child dies of malaria. Malaria is a disease that comes from monkeys. Basically, Plasmodium malariae came from chimpanzees originally, and it jumped to humans. It's now jumped from humans as people moved from Africa and went to South America. It's now jumped from humans back to South American primates, and we have almost no idea of the impact of that new malaria on the South American primates. Plasmodium vivax is thought to be a malaria derived from a monkey malaria strain about 40 to 60,000 years ago in Southeast Asia. There is a relatively new type of malaria, the last one, which is a malaria that has jumped into humans in Southeast Asia, probably from macaques. And you have situations like this, where basically this person has a macaque as a pet, and it's not too hard to kind of think of how that disease would jump between the species barrier. So what's become a kind of a buzz trend really right now is people are talking about emerging infectious diseases. And there's whole panels of the National Science Foundation that are basically to fund, everyone calls them EIDs. And this is basically from a study that basically said recently there's been an increase in incidence of new diseases, increase in geographical range, movement of into new host populations, and recently we've discovered a lot of new types of diseases. And there are causes of kind of newly evolved pathogens. So this is based on kind of a widely cited paper. And this is some of the evidence that kind of shows you that this has happened. So this is the number of EIDs, emerging infectious diseases. We have to all have to have a good jargon. Different types of things, so helminths, fungus, protozoans, etc., across time. And it shows probably a pretty nice increase in the number of diseases that we're describing over time. Now I'm going to be just a little bit of my normal kind of skeptical self and say there's really reasons to be pretty skeptical about this. One, we have greatly new improved diagnostic facilities. We can do genetic testing now in the field, real time. We have much more improved surveillance. We have improved media attention. You know, some of you must have read some of these books. And then we have increased attention by scientists that are capitalizing on three. You know, basically, because of the media attention, there's more money out there. Because there's more money out there, scientists basically are going to go after that money and do more research in that area. And I plead guilty to doing that. However, we know that people are increasingly coming in contact with primates, and we know that this leads to transmission. I'll give you just a quick example, which comes from our work. This is E. coli. E. coli is basically very, very widespread. All of you have E. coli. Basically, you have kind of colonies of it basically in your stomachs. All warm-blooded mammals do, birds do. But as you kind of are isolated, so if you basically have an isolated population, over time, your E. coli genetics basically drifts through genetic drift. And it becomes kind of reset once you get exposed to another type of E. coli. And what this is a genetic tree. So if you're kind of familiar with genetics, you'll probably understand this. If not, basically, the kind of bars at the end mean you're more closely related. And the A, B, C, D is that they're statistically kind of all the same within that bar. Their samples are taken from three different types of animals. The red bar is red colobus, which I worked on for a long time. Black bar is black and white colobus. The gray bar is humans, and this is one of my PhD students that helped on this research. And all I want you to see is that they're basically kind of intermingled. You get a red bar next to a gray bar next to a white bar, which means that there's been exchange of E. coli between these three species very, very frequently. And we can explore how these things happen. The thing that I actually didn't think would work when we actually did that study, and this is done with a colleague out of the University of Wisconsin called Tony Goldberg. Tony was very adamant, and he wanted to look for antibiotic-resistant genes. And I said, no way this is going to work. But Tony said, yes, it would, but I was wrong. Tony was right. Most humans, so 81.6% of the humans tested in our local region, have, and 4.4% of the chimpanzees harbor E. coli that is resistant to locally available antibiotics. So what that means is the chimpanzees have somehow been exposed to either the antibiotics, but they're not taking them, or an E. coli that has been adapted to these new types of antibiotics. And it's really nice. You can go in and figure out the sales of the different types of antibiotics, and the ones that are sold more are basically the ones that have the are showing up as being antibiotic resistant. So you want to ask the question, why are we coming into contact? And this is kind of one of the plugs I want to kind of bring home. This is kind of just a reality of what's happening, particularly in the tropics. And I'd like to say that, you know, kind of give this next message because people don't think so much about the tropics in Canada. But tropical forests can look like this. This is Kibale National Park, where we've been working for the last 20 years, as Tony said. Or it can look like this. this is a nice picture because this is the side of a national park, and you can guess which is national park and which is not. Tropical countries are losing something like 12.5 million hectares of forest annually. I don't know about you. I can think of what a hectare is. It's about the size of a football field. 12.5 is way too abstract for my small brain. State of Florida is 14 million hectares, and it's never so impressive to put things into, you know, provinces like Quebec. But basically, in 10 years, the size of half the province of Quebec is deforested in the tropics. So that kind of gives you an idea of the extent it's deforested. So deforesting is basically does not include timber harvesting. I'll kind of explain that to you in a minute. The FAO considers deforestation to be when it's less than 10% of the trees left standing. That's deforested. If you have 11% of the trees standing, it's still called a forest. Tropical logging is not considered deforestation. So basically situations like this, which you see in Congo, are not initially resulting in deforestation. In a lot of Africa, a lot of the deforestation is also caused not by this kind of extensive logging for big timber. It's often caused by people basically harvesting wood for basically, these are people taking wood out of the national park for basically cooking their local meals. About 6 million hectares of tropical forest is logged each year. So that's about the size of Ireland. When you think of the tropics, you don't think about very dry areas. You think about kind of moist, humid forest, kind of with, you know, basically leaves kind of dripping with moisture. But in reality, a lot of the tropical forests are dry. And these are some of the most endangered areas in the world, major habitats. And it's hard to estimate the amount of forest that is burnt each year. But if you estimate something like 3 million hectares burned each year, then the amount of forest that's either deforested, logged, or burned is about 21 million hectares. And remember, the size of the state of Florida is 14 million hectares. So I don't really care about how you want to kind of quibble about these numbers. It doesn't really matter. The bottom line is a lot. And, of course, it's in sequence. What comes in usually is you go in and you log an area. The logging companies put roads in. That opens it up for people to come in. They basically use agriculture where they burn it. That then leads to total deforestation. So it's a sequence. I want to put this in something that matters to me. So I like primates. So this area would have supported a population of about 32 million primates. So basically each year we're causing the death of something like 32 million primates. And that's just if you're thinking about one little tiny little bit of biodiversity. We're not sure about the number of things that will be found in the moss for sure. Be way more. The story I'm telling you right now is very biased. That's just talking about what's happening to the forests. A lot of the forests in, well, throughout the tropics is basically extensively harvested for what people are calling bushmeat. So this is someone going out basically to capture animals at night for meat that can be sold either to a local village, to use as his household, or basically kind of sold internationally. And this is kind of a harvest at one night. And if you don't like gruesome pictures, probably don't look at the next couple of pictures. This is the back of a pickup truck in the Congo, a market that basically where they're basically selling fresh primates. Typically, you'll get animals that are sold like this because they go deep into the forest to hunt. Then they'll dry the meat and sell the meat dried. This is one of our former field assistants, and he's basically removing a snare. He's not actually setting it, but snare hunting is a really big industry, if you want to call it that. This is a chimpanzee that probably got caught in a snare. Chimpanzees are powerful enough, particularly in their upper body, that he probably just ripped the snare off. He would have had the wire attached around his wrist. That wire would have become infected, and he lost his hand because of that. The knock on his chin is because he fell out of a tree because he was trying to climb without two hands. So this is kind of the baseline, and some of that hunting actually is influencing disease transmission, as you can guess. In remote villages in Cameroon, about 60% of the community reports having butchered primates. And 1% of the people test positive for a type of virus called simian foamivirus. The nice thing about this virus is it's a really good way of indicating exposures to new viruses. It's a type of virus that has no known effects to humans. So if you get it, you don't die. So you can basically be tested 10 years later, and you know that you acquired that virus sometime in your past. So you can look at the probability of acquiring new viruses through basically this bushmeat trade. So what this kind of does, I think, is raises the kind of intriguing question is what sorts of kind of anthropogenic disturbances lead to diseases playing a more significant role in determining primate population size and in determining kind of the spread of these diseases. So we've done studies that looked at various things. I'm going to run through them really quite quickly. We've looked at logging and disease. So we all know the effect of logging. You take away habitat, but does it affect disease? This is where we work, so basically in eastern Africa, in Uganda, on kind of the very far western side. We've been working in Kibale National Park. And we study, for this project, we looked at basically gastrointestinal parasites, so basically worms that are found in the animal's stomachs, and you can detect them because you can get them from the feces. Oops. And this is just one indices of the parasite infection. This is the mean number of parasite species per individual for three different species. The green bar is the undisturbed forest. The blue bar is the logged forest. And you can see for one of the species, I don't think I know why, but for one of the species, they're dramatically affected by logging. The other two are not. Let's make Andy a little bit happy. Let's talk about fragmentation. And Andy was really talking about some of the causes of kind of extinctions and what was happening. We've looked at fragmentation in about four studies now, and this is just kind of one of them. This is the percentage of the basically animals that have more than one parasite species. For red colobus from the forest interiors, the first bar versus the forest edge, so near the edge of a forest fragment. And basically, if you're near the edge, you have more parasites. Black and white colobus, you have the same situation. So a process that might be happening in these fragments that's causing some of this extinction that Andy was talking about is basically diseases are intensifying. Well, if we're talking about kind of what's kind of influencing animal populations, which is really what I'm really interested in, we wanted to know the role of diseases. It's unlikely that disease is always going to play, or often going to play even, kind of a sole factor. So it's unlikely that there's going to be a single factor to explain really complex biological phenomena like population regulation. And there's a really nice study done in the 1980s which kind of demonstrated this. And this was a study that was very kind of fortuitous. A woman was basically working on an island studying sheep populations when that population started to go through a population crash. And she documented the fact that the sheep that were out in the wild had very poor nutrition, so there wasn't much food left, but they also had lots of parasites. So what she did is she basically took some of those sheep with lots of parasites, brought them into captivity, and gave them a nutritious diet. They did fine. And she went out into the field and dewormed some sheep, and basically they now have poor nutrition because they're still in the field, but they don't have those parasites, and they did fine. It's only when you had the combined factors that basically things were kind of a lot worse. She, again, was looking at kind of gastrointestinal parasites. Well, I was kind of too impatient to wait until I'd see like, one of those population kind of trends. Might happen next year. It might happen 20 years from now. So basically, researchers usually monitor populations for long periods to witness if changes in nutritional status and parasitism are associated with changes in population size. So we kind of, in a way, cheated. We basically went and we studied forest fragments outside of the national park. And so we have 20 fragments. These are all kind of basically individual populations. And we documented that over a 10-year period, there's about an average of a 21% decline in the populations. And that ranged from a 25% increase to a 57% decline. We identified and measured every tree in those fragments to quantify the availability of their food resources. We watched groups of each of the monkeys for about 4,000 hours to determine which were the food species, particularly for the red colobus. And we documented that the average cumulative DBH, which is diameter at breast height, so you can think of that as the total size of the trees that they feed on, declined by about 34%. But that ranged from a 2% gain to a 71% decline. Now, people who look at the numbers are going to say, well, how come we're talking about declines in all these situations? These are locally owned forest fragments. They're not inside a national park. So this is basically how you make charcoal. So you cut down a tropical tree, you cut it into pieces, you cover it with dirt and grass, it burns slowly, and you can sell the charcoal to cities because it makes basically less smoke, and it's basically a good fuel source. The area that we work in is one of the kind of the moonshine capitals of Uganda. But to make your local gin, you have to basically keep your still going. Uganda is increasing economically. People now want to live in brick houses. We live in a brick house. So to basically bake your bricks, you basically chop down a tropical tree. Or you simply use your trees for things like doors and tables. You actually use the timber. And the reason this has become an increased rate of deforestation or increased rate of change is because they fixed the road. When we first got to the area, we used to leave kind of right at the break of dawn and hopefully get to the field station by at just before dusk. And if you're unlucky, you got stuck in the middle of the road because the truck basically got stuck in the road and you waited behind it. Now we can get there in 5 hours. We have, basically, we looked at the parasite infection in each of those groups. This just gives you an example. And what we found, kind of in a nutshell, and I'll give you kind of summarize this two ways, increased deforestation, and this is basically increasingly removing the number of food trees from these fragments, means the populations decline. Increased deforestation also meant that the parasite infections are increased. If you have increased parasite infection, you get decreasing population decline. I'll go through this really quickly if people want to kind of more detail. You can do what's called a path analysis, which will show you kind of the relative strengths. So nutritional status has a direct effect on population. Nutritional status has an indirect effect. Probably if you have poor nutrition, you have a poor immune system, which means you get more parasites. If you have more parasites, you have basically declining in population. So we can show that they both have independent effects. We want to think about the future, what's going to happen. One of the things we're really interested in, of course, is global climate change. And this is kind of the statistics of what people document. The area we work in is actually much higher, and I'll get to that in a second. But we all know kind of human medical literature basically documents really good connections between climate and disease outbreaks. So meningitis, for instance, erupts during the dry season. Heavy rains are associated with outbreaks of waterborne diseases. And malaria increases when there's an increased rain and with an increase in temperature. And just one example, associated with an increase in rain in Rwanda between 1984 and 1988, there's a 266% increase in human malaria rates. We don't have that sort of data for primates or for basically almost any animal, so we kind of have to make guesses from based on this. Kibali is a region that has experienced kind of dramatic climate change. It's very localized, but the region we work in has 300 millimeters more rainfall a year than it did at the start of the century. We have less frequent droughts, we're getting more rain, we have an earlier onset of the rainy season, and we have a 4.4 increase in the average maximum monthly temperature over the last 40 years. Just to show you the rainfall, that's what the rainfall looks like. So we have basically a pretty linear increase in rainfall. And we know from basically the cattle industry that wet conditions allow parasite eggs to persist longer, and that increases the risk of getting these sorts of infections. So we wanted to know if that would influence the primates. We have kind of two different situations we can look at. Within an area, we can look at wet areas, so the bottom of the hill versus the top of the hill. And Kibali has a rainfall gradient from the north to south, so we can look at the north versus the south. And what we found was that groups using swampy areas have elevated gastrointestinal parasites relative to groups in dry uplands. So these can be groups that are simply 200 meters apart, but one uses wet areas, one uses dry areas. Or contrasting regions, so groups in wetter sites, these are about 12 kilometers apart, have elevated gastrointestinal parasites relative to drier sites. So we suggest that in Kibali, at least, which is getting wetter, we're going to have more disease. Now, this is where we should be really kind of interdisciplinary, and we really need some physicists in the room that could actually build us our time machine, and we can go back in time, but I can't. So what we did is we did a very original study is I went and we basically, a number of us in the lab, we simply copied a study that was done in 1975. And we copied it as closely as we could. So basically we used the same methods, we went to the same groups, and we wanted to see what was happening with protozoan infections. And this basically contrasts the data between 1979 and 2009. This is the number of protozoan species. And what I'll point out is just that there's a change over time, but I'll point out specifically if you look at the red colobus, they now have protozoans, whereas before they didn't. If you look at the black and white colobus, they have protozoans, but they didn't before. On the The far side is what the 1979 data shows, and on the other side is what we found. Basically, the prevalence is the number of animals in the group that actually have this protozoon. So what was found by the earlier study, a group would either be 100% infected or not infected. What we find with each of the different species is we get a mix. And so first off is mangabeys, red colobus, the black and white colobus, and this is a blue monkey. So we get basically a change over time, which is fairly dramatic. Two species are now infected with protozoans, and we have a totally different nature of the prevalences over time. It may be related to, we could try to make predictions. So climate change would basically predict an increase in infections. That holds for the two colobuses, but it doesn't really hold for the other three species. We basically expect with climate change, infections would be less variable. Basically, they'd all get infected. We don't really see that. If we have increased human contact, so the population density is increasing around the park, we expect to see increased infections, which holds for the colobus, but not the other species. We'd expect the infections to be less variable, which we don't find. So I don't really know what's going on, but we have a change. And for some of the species, it basically means they're getting more intense infections. What we're doing right now, I'll just kind of quickly tell you kind of two approaches we're doing, is we're basically monitoring the local human community and exploring possibility of zoonotic transfers. So basically, zoonotic transmission is basically when people are picking up diseases that may come from the primates in particular. So we're looking at, in some cases, the genetics of the diseases. Are they actually being transmitted? So these are the diseases that people actually report. And what we're doing, we're simply mapping this around the national park. And this is basically shows different diseases. This is the work by one PhD student. And basically, from this, what we can do with all these diseases is basically have a disease index, and we can see where the hotspots of human diseases are, and we can look at whether or not there are hotspots of similar diseases in the primates. We're also looking for new diseases. So this is work that's primarily done in collaboration with my colleague Tony Goldberg. We've described a few new species of SIVs now. So basically, these are the viruses that are found in primates that caused AIDS in humans. So we now have three new types of basically things that potentially could be transmitted to humans to cause something like AIDS. This is the first actual public announcement of this one. We actually now found a new Ebola. The red colobus have a new strain of Ebola that is different to what has been described before. And I know two people who have been bitten by red colobus, and both of them are still alive, including me. So I think it probably doesn't cause Ebola in humans. And we're looking at trying to look at the fitness consequences. So we have long-term studies where we basically know that particular individual monkeys have a particular type of AIDS, basically, in the primates, or monkeys that have Ebola. And we're looking to see what is the fitness consequences to those animals. The animals that have Ebola are walking around doing fine. The ones that have AIDS are having babies, and we're kind of quantifying, are they having less, more? So we have kind of 5 years of data on that, and we'll kind of continue from that. And I think I'll end there. And basically, I've been saying we throughout this, so there's an awful lot of students that have been involved in this and a lot of colleagues. So I can't, this is definitely very much a collaborative research with my lab and a number of other labs. So I'd be happy to take questions.
You must be walking around with all kinds of things.
Probably.
We have time for one question.
Awesome. You sure? Okay. I think you did an outstanding job in putting the context of disease ecology and how these ecosystems are being changed through human pathways, but I'm interested to know, in your research on finding new diseases and seeing how these different ecological factors are interacting with disease interactions, well, how are these actual diseases interacting amongst each other? I mean, have you found evidence that, an increase in diversity of parasites or other types of diseases can actually increase virulence that potentially having just a smaller diversity, maybe a historical context of parasite loads may not have been so virulent, but now that you got a bunch of diseases like maybe some of us have had in the tropics, you know, you get hit with one, you're okay, you get hit with a bunch, you know, you're in serious trouble.
Yeah. The human literature is full of really great studies that do exactly that. You know, having trichura, it's a type of worm in your stomach, basically is probably no consequences if you're healthy. If you have AIDS, it starts to become a problem. If you have TB and AIDS, then you're in trouble. We don't really have that data yet for the primates. So we have this one study group, which is increasing in size. It's almost 100 animals now. And we know all of their gastrointestinal parasites. We know for certain individuals, we know their viruses. To figure out the viruses is, A, pretty difficult. You have to dart them, catch them falling out of the tree, get their blood, take their blood, be able to get the blood back to the states for the HIVs, the SIVs, has to go to the CDC, the analysis. So it's, you know, complex to do. So if you can ask me that question in about 10 years' time, I'll maybe be able to answer it. But it'll probably take me that long. Great, thanks.